to United States versus Slate. Mr. Tassif.
Good morning. At issue before this court is whether a reasonable person in Michael Slate's position would have believed that he was free to leave a police interrogation room that the district court below decried as one that should never, ever be used for voluntary interrogations.
Do we know how far the police station was from his house? I mean, it said four blocks. What was puzzling was when they found out he just had a bicycle, the police seemed to have thought it was too far for him to ride. So they offer him a ride. I didn't get that.
My understanding of the record is that the trip took no more than 5 minutes. A relatively short distance from the home to the police department.
In a car.
In the police.
Shouldn't take 5 minutes to go 4 blocks.
4 blocks or so, yes.
Now, was it bad? Wasn't there bad weather or something? Was that the problem?
It was a March.
Was it
early
was
spring day?
Snow on the ground or something?
I don't believe the weather was going to be that much an impediment. The officers posited a theory that they did not want the interview taking place at the household because there was a female occupant who was also present, plus a strong odor of cat urine in the home that would make it rather uncomfortable.
They have a cat allergy, the police officers?
They may very well have had such
allergies. You know, those allergies can be dangerous. You get asthma. Cat allergies are serious.
Indeed.
So you think the police officers were allergic? They were afraid.
No, there was nothing certainly in the
record. If they
had
asthmatic attacks while interviewing a suspect.
Yes, and certainly I would submit Mr. Slate might have been undergoing a panic attack because in the video of this interrogation that took place, it's Government Exhibit 1. These are still photographs taken.
I've seen the tape, yeah.
Very well, because at the outset of the interview, we have the two officers positioning themselves in the room, and Agent Barola, who's 6'6", 225 pounds, sits himself in this portion of the room with Mr. Slate positioned and exhibiting the kind of maybe panic attack or nervousness, to say the least, sitting in the corner. Within 10 seconds of Barola taking his seat, the video shows him then standing up and repositioning his chair closer to the door and at an angle whereby the upper left portion of his large bodily frame is blocking the door. And from that perspective and in that position, Agent Barola remained seated throughout the 55-minute first segment of the tape. And I use these stills from the video to illustrate that obviously pictures can speak louder than words, and there's very little that opposing counsel and I can say that the tape doesn't depict in terms of Mr. Slate's appearance, seated in the corner, hands to the waist, with a resigned look about him as he is being confronted with two very aggressive interrogating officers.
They're polite.
Polite.
On the tape. They're polite.
Yes, polite but firm, I would submit. Because when agent...
They're not overtly threatening, right?
No, there was no physical or overt physical kind of coercion, but there is a tension that is palpable in that room when one views this tape. And especially when the interview begins, Agent Bowers begins with this recap that I use in my brief. It's a robotic intonation that he repeats over and over and over in a very firm voice that you are not under arrest. You are not being detained. You are free to leave. And yet the first thing that Mr. Slate says in the first 30 seconds, I quote, "I had no choice. You're going to do what you're going to do. You're going to put me away anyway." Now, Bowers' immediate response is to repeat.
Did they drive him home?
No. No, they did not. And Bowers' immediate response is to begin again the intonation, "You're not under arrest. You're free to leave. You're this, you're this. You came here voluntarily." Slate's response, "I understand, but it doesn't matter because you're going to do what you got to do."
Why isn't that simply reasonably understood as a response of somebody who knows that the police have now discovered terribly incriminating evidence against him? And that's pretty easy to explain the resigned posture in those statements, isn't it? As opposed to arguing with the police about whether he's really in custody.
I would agree. That is one way of interpreting, and I believe that is what the district court below essentially held. But this being an objective standard, not the subjective intention of the officer or the suspect himself, would a reasonable person being led into a room such as this, as we see from the video, and the door being closed, and the parties positioning themselves as they did, if Mr. Slate, as the district court found, volunteered to go to the police department, I would respectfully submit that it's a quantum leap then to say that he voluntarily agreed to submit to this kind of interrogation technique. Oregon versus Mathiasen from the U.S. Supreme Court dealt with an individual who voluntarily went to the police department, was met by the police, and led to a room where the officers allowed the door to remain open and allowed the individual to go to the restroom if he so chose to. That is not the case in this matter at bar. The government's reliance on United States versus Jones, a case from the Springfield division of our district where Mr. Jones was under arrest and taken to the police department or agreed to go with the police to the police department and submit to questioning. Jones is apposite to the extent that, yes, there was an individual who agreed to go to the police department and who was interviewed and gave incriminating statements. But the deciding factor, the distinguishing factor in Jones is that Jones was, in that record, was heard to say by police that he couldn't understand why the police were treating him so well at the police department, which the district court characterized as a tip-off of what was going on in that interrogation session. That's not the case in Mr. Slate's situation.
If Mr. Slate had ridden his bike to the police station, would that have changed anything here?
Probably not.
And the other question that I wanted to ask you was this. Is the room 8x8 or is it 5x7? Do we know?
I'm sorry?
The dimensions of the room.
The dimensions of the room.
One officer 8x8, the other officer 5x7.
Well, it's ridiculous that the dimensions of a room should not be stated accurately in the record. I mean, it's ridiculous. Don't people have a tape measure or something?
One would think.
It also makes a difference. I mean, yeah. 8x8.
64 square feet.
But 5x7, I don't think.
Talking very close environs here, and especially when both officers are of a physical stature that would resemble a tight end for the Chicago Bears. I mean, 6'6", 215, 235, these are big men, and seated in that room in the manner in which they did yields an interrogation process that is every bit as coercive as the situation in People versus Gorman. I cite People versus Gorman because I was privileged at that early stage in my career to be counsel for Glenn Schicker, one of the University of Illinois students who was charged with arson to Memorial Stadium in the late 80s. And in that case, the deciding point at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court said, rendered a custodial interrogation, was the positioning of the officer barring easy egress from the room. And as Justice Steigman in the portion I quote said, when police choose to conduct interrogations in these kinds of environments, they're going to have to assume the risk that there's going to be all kinds of questions raised on a motion to suppress, challenging the environment in which this voluntary statement took place. We respectfully submit that this was a custodial, coercive, police-dominated police interrogation session, and this court ought to reverse the district court's finding and remand for further proceedings.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Tassif. Ms. Mullen?
Good morning. May it please the court. Linda Mullen on behalf of the United States. I don't want to belabor too much the point about
The police knocked on his door. This is early morning.
That's correct. It was about 7:15 in the morning.
And they opened the door or what?
They breached the door when no one came to the door after they announced their presence. They breached the door.
What do you mean they breached
they
the door?
They entered forcibly into the front door.
What do you mean? They broke it? They broke the door?
They broke down.
They kicked it in?
Yes.
Well, why did they do that? Did they think that it was empty or what?
I think no one came to the door after they knocked and announced.
Did they know someone was inside?
They didn't know one way or the other, as far as I know.
Why did they? I see. They broke in. They didn't know whether it was, but they broke the door down anyway.
No one.
Why did they enter with drawn guns?
They testified, Your Honor, that they entered with drawn guns for their safety. In a situation like this,
you know, that's not an answer.
They don't know what they're going to encounter.
Do police always draw their guns when they enter a house?
There was testimony that when they do breach a door like this and they are entering a house to conduct a search warrant, that they do have their guns drawn typically. They reholstered those guns almost immediately upon assessing the situation. They found, of
course... Now, why didn't they question him in the house? I didn't understand that from the brief.
The original plan and the testimony from Agent Barola was that they were going to interview. They had planned to interview the defendant in the house. Once they got to the house, they had to assess the conditions of the house. They had two people in the house. They weren't expecting that. I don't think they were expecting a roommate in the house. There was only one chair in the entire house. The house was very small.
There were two rooms, weren't they?
There were two bedrooms, and then there was a very small living room and a very small galley kitchen. In the living room area, there was only one chair in the room. There was also no natural light coming into the home because all of the windows had been sealed.
Why did they need natural light?
I think that it just in terms of, you know, they have papers that they're reading and questions
light.
That they
was
want to ask.
Is there artificial light?
I assume that there was some sort of lamp or something, although I don't think that the record reveals that one way or the other. But at any rate, the officers looked at the condition of the home.
There's no evidence that there wasn't enough light for them to interview him.
No, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that there was not enough light for them
Why
to interview.
Why didn't they just ask the roommate to step into the other room?
They felt that even apartment was so small that even had they asked her to step into the other room, that the two would be able to overhear one another's conversation.
What do you mean one another's conversation? The roommate would be talking in the other room? What are you talking about?
I'm sorry?
What do you mean overhear each other's conversation?
They were going to interview and did interview both of the people in the house. They were concerned that if they conducted both of those interviews simultaneously in the house, that the suspects or the two occupants of the house would be able to overhear what the other one was saying. That was concerning to them.
The issue, I gather, it was you've got a computer. The question is who's got access to it, who's controlling it, and you wanted to make sure you had straight stories.
That's right. And who was password protected, who wasn't, who was using the computer, who owned the computer, things of that nature. And those were the questions that were asked. But at the end of the day, Your Honor, they asked Mr. Slate whether he would participate in a voluntary interview. He first answered that question. Well, he first asked, am I under arrest? They said, absolutely no, you're not under arrest.
They had probable cause to arrest him.
They had probable cause to arrest him, I believe, at that point. I think that they wanted to question him first, and sometimes
without the Miranda warnings, obviously.
I think that's right. I think that they wanted to question him without the Miranda warnings. But the issue here is whether or not he was in custody when he went to the police station, and they did ask him to voluntarily accompany him there. He agreed to do that. They asked him, would you please follow us in your vehicle? He at that point said, I don't have a vehicle, I only have a bicycle. They then offered, would you like a ride to the police station? He said, yes, I would. He was driven to the police station. He was in the front seat of a civilian car.
But this room is unbelievable.
It's disturbingly small.
He couldn't, realistically, he's not going to get up and brush past that bruiser sitting next to the door. That's just not realistic.
Well, I think it's not a question of whether he would brush past him. There's nothing in this record that suggests that the mere size of the room was enough to transform this into something that was coercive. It's not about whether or not...
I just don't think someone in that position, in that minute room with these two large policemen, one of them sitting next to the door, he's not going to get up and leave.
Well, I believe he wasn't going to get up and leave, Judge Posner, because he wanted, as you can see when you listen to...
Get up and leave.
Well, he didn't ask to...
Look, the only reason the police had for putting him in this room was to intimidate him. There are other rooms in that police station, obviously.
There are other rooms in the police station. The two police officers who interviewed the defendant did not choose the room. They asked the Rock Island Police Department, may we have an interview room? The officers didn't know what room would be used before they got there, so they didn't know the size of the room either. We're not going to stand here. I'm not going to stand here and say that this was a spacious, comfortable room.
Look, this is all a game that the police are playing. They have ample probable cause to arrest him. Instead of doing that, they put him into the little room because they know he's going to talk. They know that without the Miranda warnings. That's the game.
Well, he's already said he's going to talk. He's already said he's going to voluntarily participate in this interview.
He might not have talked if he was in his home.
Well, he agreed to be interviewed before they asked to relocate him. So I don't think there's an inference.
They barge in, they break down the door, they come in with guns drawn, and then they say, oh, we'd like to talk to you. Would you like to come to the police station with us, or shall we arrest you?
Well, clearly he was making...
They would have arrested him, right? If he said no, they would have arrested him. Of course they would have arrested him.
I think they would have waited to perform the forensics on the computer, but they said at that point he would have been free to go. I think that what we need to do here, though, is really look at the content of the interview.
I understand. If the Supreme Court wants to overrule Miranda, which it probably does, that's fine with me. I don't have any love of the Miranda case. But it's being rendered meaningless by this new strategy, which is you get the person to confess before you give them the Miranda warnings. You do it in subtle ways, breaking down a door, guns, invitation to the police station, treating him nicely, but then putting him in this postage-sized room with the two big cops.
Well, I'd like to address...
Break someone down, right?
The sorts of statements that Mr. Slate made, and I think that's important here because when you, as you have done, you hear the content of the discussion that the officers have with Mr. Slate, he's very careful to answer some questions and not other questions. He does not appear to be coerced during that interview. There's never a time where he asks to leave, he asks for a bathroom break. He's very careful about what kinds of things he's willing to answer and what kinds of things he backs off on. If he thinks that it serves...
That's a perfectly good argument against Miranda, right? I mean, what you're saying is you're rewinding the tape. Before Miranda, the question was whether the interrogation was coercive. And the argument you're making now, not coercive, he was in control, he answered some question, that's saying he's not coerced. Well, that's fine. The issue isn't whether he's coerced. The issue is whether you're bypassing Miranda, whether these police are bypassing Miranda.
The issue is whether or not he was in custody, and the issue there becomes whether a reasonable person would have...
The reason for all this, they want to question these people before they give them Miranda warnings. And then the question is, well, how do they do that? And they do it with breaking in doors. And why'd they break in the door? They have all the evidence they need against him. They had that. That's in the affidavit for the search warrant.
The defendant isn't claiming...
Break into his door, pour down his door, they could come back when someone was there.
The defendant is not claiming, though, Judge Posner, that he did not go voluntarily to the police department. That was never an allegation made in the brief on appeal.
It's not what's voluntary and what's involuntary. The question is, when you look at all of this together, were his incriminating statements extracted in violation of the Miranda rule? And there are many ways in which you can violate Miranda. Here it's done subtly. The cat smell. I mean, that's the most ridiculous, right? The police are upset because there's a smell of cats.
Well, I think that that speaks to the overall condition of the home.
Allergic?
Certainly they wanted to...
Allergic.
There was actually testimony in the record, it's funny that you should raise that, that two of the officers were allergic to cats, and that's why they opened
probably
the front door.
Probably the ones picked to...
I wasn't going to mention it. there is actually testimony.
It's a new one. You get police with serious allergies, and every time they go into someone's home, they say, because that is the criminal class, they're not as meticulous. It's the upper middle class, so they send their allergic police, and the policeman... I'm uncomfortable. There's some dust in the atmosphere. Please, will you come to the police station with us? I don't want to have an asthmatic attack in your home.
I see that my time has expired. I'm happy to answer any questions. I'm not sure if that was a question. Sounded more like a statement than a question, but I'm happy to address any additional questions.
Yeah, I wondered if you think there's a difference. I mean, is there a difference between being in custody and formal arrest? Or was Agent Barola simply confused, you know, when he said Slate was in custody but not under formal arrest?
I think that's a fair question, Judge Rovner, and I think that clearly the officers in this case were confused about the semantics or the terminology, and in their mind, they think of custody as formal arrest. They're not thinking through the legal jargon of the cases and what do we mean when we say custody.
As far as they're concerned, he was under custody when they entered his house.
Well, they certainly...
They knew everything. They knew every step that was going to...
Are you suggesting they didn't know the nuances here of Miranda? And
they were very careful to
protect the record.
That's right, they were. And that's not what I'm speaking to. There's some testimony in the record where, and you'll see it on the tape if you haven't viewed the tape yet, where...
I have not.
One officer... when they leave the defendant in the room for a period of time, they go check with the forensics expert. They come back in. One officer starts to administer the Miranda warnings at that point, and Mr. Slate says, you know, am I under arrest? And the officer says, well, no. And the other officer interrupts and says, no, he is at this point. They seem confused at the time. So there was questioning about that at the suppression hearing, and the officer was asked, why did you say at that point that he wasn't under arrest? And he said, I was, in my own mind, not thinking about custody. I was thinking about formal arrest, and we hadn't gone through the process of formally arresting him, and that's why I was confused when I was talking to Mr. Slate, and the other agent had to interrupt and correct me. Clearly, at that point, Mr. Slate was in custody for the purposes of Miranda, and no one disputes that, and that's not an issue on appeal today. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. So, Mr. Tassif, have something for you?
These state and federal officers planned every detail of this investigation. Indeed, in their operations plan, and this is revealed at the motion transcript, pages 15 through 16 and 139 through 140, they made arrangements and reserved the room at the local police department before they even breached the door and made their entry and took Mr. Slate from his bedroom at gunpoint.
Is that the only room in that police station?
I believe there are other rooms.
Are they all the same size?
I don't know.
How big is the police? Is this some little miniature police station?
Rock Island City Police Department
assign their biggest police there, and even though
Rock Island is a community of 35,000 people, it's police department.
Is it the police station or some satellite police station? Or?
No, yes, that's the main department.
The police station for a 35,000.
That's correct.
Resident town.
Correct. And secondly, during this break in the action, when the police left the room and the door mysteriously was locked, leaving Mr. Slate in that room, Barola gets on the phone to the assistant U.S. attorney Matthew Cannon, who advises Barola, go back in there and get a Miranda waiver. Clearly, the U.S. attorney handling the investigation here had to have been concerned about how that first stage had gone. And finally, Judge Posner asked, was there probable cause to arrest? Their answers to avoid this custody question became so absurd that in the transcript on cross-examination, I asked the officers, let me get this straight. You mean if Slate had asked for a cab ride back home to get his passport so he could go to the Quad City airport and leave the United States of America outside the jurisdiction of this country. You mean to say you would let him go and he was free to leave? And the officer said, yes, he was free to leave. A convicted sex offender who was a registered sex offender, and it's all in the affidavit with respect to what they knew of him. This was all planned. It went according to plan, and they violated the rule of Miranda.
Thank you, Mr. Tassif, and we thank the defenders for their representation.